Leslie Marmon Silko lives in the American Southwest, where she paints, writes, and soaks in the natural world around her. A member of the Laguna Pueblo tribe, Silko helped put Native American literature on the map with her novel Ceremony, and is credited with being a key member of what's called the Native American Renaissance. She's the author of a memoir called The Turquoise Ledge, and she read Steve Paulson an excerpt from the book.
Steep banks of violet-blue cumulus drift over the southwest horizon, off the Gulf of California. Later in the morning, the rattlesnakes come out in anticipation of the rain. The light is pearly blue and cool enough for the snakes to await the rain. They favor spots near sources of water or shade, so it is easy to anticipate where they may be. In my yard, one rattlesnake sits next to a ceramic bowl, and its twin curls up in the rainwater drainpipe nearby. They lie in wait for little birds and rodents. When I first came to this old ranch house, there were the remains of a mesquite log corral below the hill, and I later repaired it so I could keep a horse. A big black and white western diamondback rattlesnake lived near the old corral. What interested me at once was its calm demeanor. No coiling or rattling when we met. The snake made me feel welcome here. He knew I was a friend of snakes. I was careful to watch for him around the hay barn where he got fat on pack rats. If I found the big snake in the shade of the corral fence when I was making repairs, he patiently tolerated a gentle lift in the bowl of the shovel to a more out-of-the-way place in the shade. I called him Baby as a joke because it was an unlikely name for a rattler 4 feet long and about 5 inches in diameter. He was a grandfather snake, not a baby. He kept me company for my first 2 summers in Tucson. But after the summer of 1980, when I was away in New Mexico much of the time, he left. The black and white color of the snake was dazzling and unusual, and I always hoped I might see another rattler like him. But more than 30 years later, I have not. Maybe the old snake was a messenger of welcome and more supernatural than I realized at the time.
Oh, that's a wonderful passage. Do you think you had a relationship with that snake? I mean, do you think that snake kind of knew who you were?
I absolutely think so. And part of the reason is because all of the research that's been done very recently by animal intelligence researchers, research done with birds, ravens, even pigeons, and of course, the famous African gray parrot research projects. And I believe what's emerging is a new view of the organization of the bird brain and the reptilian brain. Always before, they had compared the reptile brain or the bird brain with mammalian brains, with our brains. And in fact, when I was a child, us children would yell at one another, "Oh, you bird brain," meaning, you know, not very smart because you have a small brain. Now it's emerging that bird brains are to our mammal brains as the old-time tube radios are to digital electronics. And the rattlesnakes very much learn to recognize people. I have a rattlesnake that's lived in the house with us for about 24 years.
Wait, in the house? You let
him rattle? Well, not roaming around freely, but in his little house, Evo's little, well, not so little. It's a big box, a big glass box. And when I bring strangers to introduce them or show them to Evo, he very much reacts and knows that they are human beings that he's not met before.
You don't worry about getting bitten? I mean, not with Evo, who lives near you, obviously knows you well, but just a rattlesnake you might stumble on one of your walks?
Well, I'm very careful about that. And a couple of times on my walks, I've had to hop over. Literally, I've looked down, and with my next step, I sort of jump or skip where they've been coiled right on the trail. I'm without illusions. I know that I have to be very watchful. Every person does. It's a form of discipline to pay attention to, you know, to where you are, because yes, I believe that if you bump a snake or step on a snake, that that snake has a right to bite you and you should expect to be bitten. However, my experience has been that they are very forgiving, and that if you're not bothering them or attacking them, but you're just walking along, they'll allow you just to hop over them or step over them like I have.
Hmm. Now, there's a strong spiritual current that runs throughout your memoir. Clearly, you have a deep reverence for the land that you live on. But it goes further than that. And you talk about star beings, which have been the subject of paintings you've done. And I guess before we talk about the paintings, I should just ask, what are star beings?
Well, in the art and in the lore of the Mayan people and the Nahuatl or Aztec-speaking people, actually there's a whole cultural complex that goes from Guatemala all the way, you know, into Canada, in the Americas, among indigenous people, and accounts of beings coming to Earth and visiting indigenous groups. And some indigenous communities will say that they are offspring. Others will say no, but we were told, we were given technology, or we were told to settle here, so that you can go into many different lores and writings of the Americas and find references to visitors from the stars. But especially when you go to Mexico and you see the Aztec and Mayan pyramids, there's a great pyramid to Venus, to the planet Venus. And we now know from other sorts of research and oral literature and so forth, that many of the ceremonies were tied into the appearance of the Pleiades in a certain place, or the shift of Venus from morning star to evening star. And so the ancient people of the Americas, from South America all the way to the Arctic Circle, the people were sky watchers. They were astronomers. The presence of the star beings can be seen in the art with the, it looks like a cross, but this cross is not a Christian cross. It's the sign for Venus, or the sign for stars. And in the Pueblo cultures of the Southwest, and Laguna Pueblo is one of them, you can see in some of the Katsina or Kachina figures, those figures which represent the sun or Venus or the stars.
Well, and you say they don't much like human beings.
Well, they don't much like human beings, and they don't much approve of how we treat one another and what we're doing with this world. And so from time to time, they visit. I'm not sure that they always deal with us humans kindly, because they've not a lot of respect for what we humans have done to one another and the earth.
And I get the impression from reading your memoirs, I mean, this is not just metaphor you're talking about. I mean, you feel like you communicate with these star beings.
Well, I do. And of course, the fiction writer always has to be on the lookout for straying over into the world of fiction and fictional beings and have that world sort of push out the everyday world. But I really, after I began to spend time and thought on them, and especially when I was painting their portraits, I really began to understand that these communications with us from such entities is very much like the communication with wild animals and things. It's not done verbally or out loud necessarily. It's done by thought, of course. And once again, thought communication breaking with these languages, English or Spanish or Nahuatl, that come loaded with all of these different, actually, limitations and prejudices. And you would imagine that advanced beings like the star beings would just be able to use, you know, come into human thoughts and human intuition. And so that is how I experience their presence.
Leslie Marmon-Silko is a celebrated writer and the author of the memoir The Turquoise Ledge.